Professor Charlie Fenster of the South Dakota State University Department of Biology and Microbiology has received an award from the Fulbright Scholar Program to do research in Trondheim, Norway. Fenster is an evolutionary biologist who directs the Oak Leaf Field Station, and he begins his seven-month stint at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology next year. He's joining us now for a brief preview of that collaboration. Charlie, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks a lot, Lori. It's a pleasure to contribute to your program.
I was looking up some of your offerings online, and you have this wonderful way of explaining to the non-technical reader or listener about your research and why it focuses on plants and fauna. Tell us, for the people who don't really understand what an evolutionary biologist does, what's your focus of work?
Sure. Well, I like to explain to my South Dakota neighbors that I study genesis. So that's the origin of biological diversity, species. And let's take it to chapter 6 and the Ark story. And I'm also interested in the conservation of species.
What are some of the similarities and differences between what you expect to experience in Norway versus, say, the grasslands of South Dakota? How do these two places kind of intersect in your research?
Well, that's a great question. The overall challenge is the same, is to understand how to ameliorate the species loss, catastrophic species loss that we're observing worldwide. A major driver of species loss is conversion of the landscape to agriculture, and the land that is being under agriculture is more intensively used. There's much more inputs, fertilizer, pesticides, and so forth. So if you think back to the iconic painting of The Prairie is My Garden by South Dakota's native son, Harvey Dunn, farms don't look like that anymore. And they used to look like that here, and they used to look like that in Norway. In Norway, they don't really have as many row crops, the conversion of the landscape is really from hay meadows that are very highly diverse in terms of species to urban areas or abandonment to forests, which is much lower diversity. So the overall question is the same, is How does the landscape use at a regional scale affect biological diversity? What are the effects of the loss of biological diversity or the maintenance of biological diversity on human health and prosperity, including yield? And then what sort of policy chains can drive human behaviors? In the United States, that might be the Farm Bill. In Norway, they have different policy levers.
I want to ask you to help explain to people. I think most people have an understanding of natural selection or genetics based on, you know, the animal kingdom or a bird evolving, you know, the beak of the finch, for example. Fairly ubiquitous story. From a flower, a plant, something growing in the earth, how is a moss, how is that different and how is it similar when you look at examining how evolution works in that context?
Great question. They're similar because of the universal genetic code, DNA, except, of course, for the organisms like the SARS-CoV virus, which is an RNA virus. But so the method of inheritance from parent to offspring is the same in plants as they are in animals. It's through DNA, and so therefore the laws of genetics and evolution apply to both. What is nice about plants is you can scale up experiments with plants to a much greater extent than with animals.
Because they are less mobile? Because they're... Why?
And because plants are less mobile.
Okay.
Absolutely. You can measure a character and among a bunch of plants and then come back and see which plants are survived or which plants are reproduced more than others. And so you can imagine that's much simpler than doing an experiment with a wild animal population, let's say mobile butterflies and so forth.
Sure. Fascinating stuff. All right, what do you hope to come out of this Fulbright Scholarship in the way of collaboration and long-term relationships with scientists in Norway?
Well, that's exactly what I hope to achieve is to have long-term collaborations with a very, very strong multi-institutional group in Norway, mm-hmm. Where I can add a little bit to them and hopefully get a lot in return in terms of ideas and approaches. And given South Dakota's heritage with Scandinavia, I'm hoping to build up exchange programs, especially with the Oak Lake Field Station, with field stations in Norway.
Interesting stuff. All right, Professor Charlie Fenster with South Dakota State University and Fulbright Scholar. We appreciate your time. We look forward to hearing more about your research and project as you go forward with the work.
You betcha.
Ahead on the program, an SDPB survey finds the availability of early childhood learning programs in the state. It's inconsistent, Jacqueline Severin reports. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Science and Technology Reporting is supported by Black Hills Information Security.
Coming up on the next Dakota Life,
we're hosting this episode from DeSmet, the little town on the prairie.
We say every time we come up here, we're just blessed.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, we are. We feel very fortunate.
Meet Shane Anderson. He's no stranger to hard work either, and he's quite comfortable on stage and in the rodeo arena.
Many of us were just shocked. We probably taken the paper for granted.
It's the little town on the prairie and so much more.
Thursday at 8, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. The museum now offers free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. More at 773-3458 or history.sd.gov.
Miss something on SDPB? Sign up for the SDPB Morning Report. Get the reporting you love straight to your email twice a week. Go more in depth with our statewide coverage, and don't miss critical segments from shows like In the Moment and South Dakota Focus. It's the news you can use, free from clutter, and best of all, free of charge. To sign up for the Morning Report, visit sdpb.org/news and scroll to the bottom.
SDPB radio listeners are company presidents, board members, and top executives in businesses around the state. Your company can reach these influential business leaders. Contact SDPB and ask about corporate support.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. A recent SDPB survey shows early childhood and preschool programs are not consistently available across the state. While some communities have access to a variety of programs, that's not the case everywhere. SDPB's Jacqueline Severin has more on the story.
Many people say their community offers some form of preschool education through a large center, a religious organization, or an in-home setting. However, a closer look at the state's early childhood offerings shows affordability and access are not equal around the state. 1,000 people across the state completed the SDPB online survey. There were separate virtual focus group interviews. The effort was a collaboration with the Cheeseman Center for Democracy at the University of South Dakota. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting provided funding for the project. South Dakota Kids Count tracks and analyzes data concerning children in the state. Zanna Berg is a South Dakota Kids Count coordinator. She says U.S. Census survey data shows 42% of South Dakota children are in some type of early education program. That means 58% are not in preschool.
Is it because parents made that decision themselves? Is it because the parents don't have other options? Or is it because parents can't afford preschool? So unfortunately, we need better data in order to understand and be able to support young children and families.
One organization is trying to remedy that data problem. The South Dakota Association for the Education of Young Children has an online tool which collects information from agencies and stakeholders across the state. Janessa Bixel is the organization's president. She says South Dakota lacks a central state agency to gather data on early childhood programs. Bixel says South Dakota is one of a few states that does not regulate or license preschools.
Somebody can say they're a preschool, but they could sit down and just give the kids worksheets all day, and they could call that learning, but that is absolutely not developmentally appropriate for early childhood. Like, early childhood children should be learning through play.
Bixel says the state is now creating a better system to regulate and track early childhood education. She says quality early childhood education doesn't require a large preschool center or public school setting. It can happen at a private daycare, at a church preschool, or even at home. What's important is that children learn through play.
Having children social and emotionally ready and able to utilize their fine motor skills and, you know, and follow directions, things like that, that is so much more important than the academic development going into kindergarten.
For some young students, pre-K programs can make the transition to school easier.
You do see those kids seem to start to grasp onto the academics more quickly, just because, you know, they have more of that social-emotional piece.
Cher Daniel is the principal at Rapid Valley Elementary in Rapid City, South Dakota. Rapid Valley is a Title I school. 40% of its students come from low-income families. The school has a pre-K program for 3 to 5 year olds paid for with special education money. It mainly serves children who have developmental delays, but can accept about 4 students per class without special needs, as long as they come from a qualifying school district. Daniel says there's a waiting list for the program, which suggests an unfilled need.
We'll get a call. We can usually get a parent call about once a week, just asking, do we have a preschool? Is there room? So definitely we see a need based on the phone calls that we get.
The state tracks only limited data on early learning programs, but there is one organization with solid numbers. That is the Federal Head Start Program. Zanna Berg with Kids Count says American Indian children make up about 56% of the state's Head Start enrollment.
And this is likely because there are 8 tribal Head Start programs that tribes located within South Dakota run. So really, this data underscores the importance of Head Start for these tribal communities.
One retired tribal educator agrees. Chris Bordeaux spent most of his career teaching gifted and talented students at tribal schools. He says Head Start is a good program, but with limited spaces, many families end up on waiting lists. He also says one problem with Head Start is that its requirements can exclude people.
I remember when our oldest daughter was in Head Start, you know, we didn't have any problems with that. But when our youngest daughter came along, our income was higher and she was not eligible for Head Start.
Bordeaux says tribal communities don't have many other options for preschool besides Head Start. He says the children who lose out on learning skills early on can get left behind, and that sometimes affects the rest of their educational career. The SDPB survey confirms early childhood education is available for Native American children through tribal-based programs like Head Start. However, fewer programs are generally available for tribal communities. SDPB's statewide survey is part of an initiative from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Coming Home Project supports deeper understanding of rural places. The information will be released to the public June 1st. The Cheeseman Center at USD hopes governments, businesses, and nonprofits will make use of the data. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jacqueline Severin in Sioux Falls.
You can find more of our SDPB Coming Home survey coverage on our website at sdpb.org/news. That's where you can listen again and share. Now ahead on the program, the June SDPB Spotlight shines on rodeo in South Dakota. We're going to explore the traditions, the economic impact, and the heritage of one of the state's most popular sports. We'll begin today with rodeo veteran Billy Sutton from Burke. You're in the moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Great question. That is a great question.
And that's a great question.
Wow, that's another great question.
That's a great question.
Oh, that's a great that's a great question.
That is a great question.
What a great question.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear unexpected questions and unexpected answers. This afternoon at 2, One Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding with your support. And by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly with Gene Hufford Agency Incorporated. GeneHufford.com.
For immigrant families, assimilation can mean losing a crucial part of one's identity, language.
I realized I had to engage in a different world of English, so you know, I should just let go and go with English.
That's a big decision for a little kid to make.
Well, my need for survival was greater than my hurt.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, Reclaiming Language, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB. Take In the Moment with you wherever you go with the In the Moment podcast. New episodes drop every Friday and feature the best of the week from news and the arts. Download and subscribe to In the Moment wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, welcome to June in South Dakota. We're spending this month celebrating the tradition of rodeo in our state. We begin by welcoming one of the state's most iconic rodeo athletes, Billy Sutton. Sutton grew up on a ranch near Burke before getting a full-ride rodeo scholarship from the University of Wyoming at Laramie. He was the school's all-time leader in rodeo points, and he rode on the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association circuit, where he ranked in the top 30 worldwide. His professional career was cut short when a bucking horse flipped on top of him in the chute during a Minot, North Dakota rodeo. That accident partially paralyzed Billy Sutton, and it changed the course of his life. Billy Sutton is joining us now to talk about rodeo, tradition, and how faith and love helped him reconsider his identity, even as he continues to ranch and ride here in South Dakota. Billy, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
We always talk politics and leadership and community service, and I am so delighted to talk rodeo with you because I've never had that conversation with you. So thanks for saying yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad to do it. It's a fun conversation.
Take me back to when you're a little shaver and your very first rodeo experience. Like, how much is this part of a family tradition, and what are some of the earliest memories that you have of rodeo?
Well, it was a family tradition. You know, my grandpa was involved in rodeo. Oh gosh, I mean, probably 60, 70 years ago. Hmm. He actually had some bucking stock with the late great Casey Tibbs, and so we have that history. And so my dad rodeoed. My mom also got involved in rodeo, and we grew up on our family ranch, and it was just like there wasn't any question that you were going to rodeo. It's just probably to what degree you took, you know, you went on from there. But it is such a rich tradition for so many families. And it's become a sport, though, of not just ranch families, you know, as it's been elevated through media and, you know, some of the stars like Casey Tibbs. It's not just ranch families anymore.
Yeah. So how do you get involved in it when you're a little kid? What are some of the events that, was the first thing that you did to participate in rodeo? Was it a social gathering or was it, you know, a competitive thing?
I'd say both, but when you're that young, you know, it's certainly a social aspect of it. But I mean, we grew up on a ranch and grew up on horses at a very, very young age. I mean, my mom even tells stories where she was packing me on with her on the horse as early as, you know, 1 and 2 years old. And so you grow up that way. And then, you know, my parents started taking me to junior rodeos. And then you just start taking steps from there. You want junior rodeo, then 4-H rodeo. You know, they also have little britches rodeos, which I didn't do, but a lot of people do. Yeah. And then you go to high school rodeo and college rodeo and amateur rodeo, then professional rodeo. You know, so it's kind of a stepping stone deal, but very young. I mean, I started going to junior rodeos as early as probably 5 and 6 years old, you know, even doing things like calf roping on foot. You know, I don't know if they still do that in Nebraska, but we used to go, and you'd put all these kids out in the arena, and then they'd let a herd of calves out, and you'd go, you know, have to rope one on foot, and the first one to do it won, and kids would be getting wiped out. And, I mean, it was wild.
Okay, so at what point do you say, hey, that horse that bucks and throws people off, I want to do that? Like, how do you pick some of your events, especially these events, to the novice or the outsider like me? You know, that looks like it looks pretty dangerous. Just, you know, like, who chooses that? So tell me that choice. You know, what is that process of inviting into a certain event like Rough Stock?
Well, I think, you know, you start as 10 events, and they're starting to do more Rough Stock at a younger age. Like, they'll ride steer, you know, put a bronc saddle on a steer, you know, or maybe it's a miniature pony or something like that. So they're doing more of that now. But back when I was that age, you know, you maybe did calf riding, which would kind of start you down the road of bull riding. But they didn't really have anything for, you know, like bucking horses at that young age, which, you know, it's probably good. But we started doing time events first. And then, you know, as you go to rodeos, you're watching, you know, as you grow up, you're watching other people compete in those other events, or you're watching on TV. You know, my first memories of bronc riding were watching, you know, great South Dakota bronc riders on TV at the NFR, the National Finals Rodeo, including my hero of bronc riding, Billy Ettbauer, who is originally from South Dakota. And watching him, I just remember watching it, you know, that and the calf rope. And those are the two events that I was like, I'm going to do both of those events. They just were so fun to watch and just sparked something in me.
Yeah.
And so I would say that I started originally as being more of calf roping was more my main event. You know, I won state in calf roping as a junior. But I didn't really get really good at bronc riding until I was probably, you know, real good once I was in, you know, college. But even in high school, I probably kind of figured it out about the time I was a junior. But actually, I was riding bulls in 4-H and the junior division, and got to the senior division and the bulls got bigger and I didn't. And my dad said, you're not going to do both. You can either ride broncs or you can ride bulls. We're not going to do both. And that was just because it takes a toll on your body. And so I just decided to ride broncs, and gosh, the rest is history. I mean, I just fell in love with it, and it's all I wanted to do. I mean, it gets a hold of you, to your core, and it just becomes a part of you.
All right. For the uninitiated, bronc riding is what, and how do you do it for the first time? And let's get into some of the nuances of what some, you know, what are judges looking for? What are some of the things that, you know, the uninitiated might see and say, hey, you know, his hand is up in the air because that looks cool. But no, this is all about. So explain to folks what they're looking at when they watch a bronc ride.
Yeah. So I think I'll take a step back and just, you know, it's the original rodeo event, really.
Okay.
The history of it goes back to even, you know, ranch hands seeing who can break a horse the best. But it's really grown from that to be, you know, the classic event of rodeo. And it's a lot about style, you know. So judges are looking for a horse that jumps and kicks and doesn't cover a lot of ground, you know, doesn't run off, doesn't, you know, a horse that really scores high, really is powerful, jumps and kicks, you know, straight up in the air. And it's a timing thing for the rider. You know, if you're in time, it's very difficult for a horse to buck you off. If you're doing all the basics correct, if it's a really good horse and you're doing the basics correct, it's hard. You know, you can really get tapped off and make really good rides. But, you know, you're looking to get your feet over the point of the horse's shoulder every jump, and then your feet come back when the horse hits the ground and regroups. And then when the horse kicks again, you got to beat that horse to the front of their shoulder with your feet, all the while lifting on your rein, and your free arm is for balance.
Okay.
And it helps you stay in the middle and keeps your, you know, keeps you back and keeps your hips in front of you if you're doing it right. And so it's a complicated sport, but it's yet our event, but it's really simple at the same time if you're doing the basics right.
All right.
The judges 1 to 25 for the horse, 1 to 25 for the rider. And as with all things, that can get political too.
Sure, right. You don't know the horse, though. Do you know the horse? Do you have any idea what how the horse is going to behave before the ride?
With young horses, you know, if you're bucking them for the first time, no. But when you go down the road professionally, you know, I used to keep track of every horse that I saw.
Yeah.
I would write down. I had this black book that my dad told me to start writing horses down when I was in high school. And believe it or not, like I remember being at the National High School Finals as a junior, writing horses down that I then saw when I was rodeoing professionally later on. And so I knew the horse, you know, because the horse has a number and, you know, the stock contractor. And so I would keep this book and have it all organized with what the horse was and how much rein you needed to give them, because some horses carry their head lower, some higher, and that makes a huge difference in how you're able to ride them. And so you do know most of the horses when you get to the professional ranks, because they're seasoned, they've been around for a while. And if they are young, they've bucked them somewhere. And so a lot of times you have to ask the contractor too.
Okay.
But you do know a lot of them.
And so I can already see how this gets a hold of you, because there's a science, there's an art, there's a, you know, a risk, an adrenaline, a sense of community and family, all of this. But you mentioned that it takes a toll on your body in the best possible circumstances. And let's talk about October 4th. Like, what, 12 years ago now? How long ago is it now that?
Yeah, it was 2007, so okay. We're going on 14
going
years
on 14
here,
years.
But yeah, right. Yeah, to believe it seems like yesterday sometimes. But so I had made it to the Badlands Circuit Finals in Minot, North Dakota. Mm-hmm. I had won the average at the Circuit Finals the year before. I was hovering right around the top 30 in the world. And it's really, like I said, you have to work your way up, because in order to get into the biggest rodeos, you have to be in the top 30-ish in the world, because some rodeos only take maybe 36 people to their rodeo. And so you really got to work your way up into the standings. And the ultimate goal is to make the top 15. So I was hoping that next year, 2008, was going to be my year, you know, because I was going to get into those big rodeos and I wasn't going to get, you know, turned away because I wasn't high enough in the standings. So I drew a horse by the name of Ruby, who I had been on a couple different times. I'd won the Clear Lake Rodeo that summer on Ruby, and she's a really good horse. You know, one of those horses that if you did your job, you were going to win. She just was good to get on, and she, you know, really bucked hard and good and just friendly to ride too. Mm-hmm. And so I sat down in the saddle, and, you know, when you think about rodeo, you worry about, you know, like a broken arm, a broken leg. That happens, you know, to about everybody at some point in their career, it seems like, or other injuries, you know, but not usually not career ending. But that day was a career ending injury for me, which is I would say somewhat rare, but it does happen from time to time. I was in the saddle reaching for my right stirrup before we got out in the arena. And Ruby flipped over on me and smashed me against the back of the chute, stood up, and I was instantly paralyzed from the waist down. And, you know, just a life-altering moment for sure, when really rodeo was my only thing that I cared about at that time. And so it was hard. It was hard.
This all happens in a second, in a flash? Like, what do you remember? Do you remember it even happening?
Yeah, I mean, I somewhat. Yeah. I remember reaching for that right stirrup. She flipped. I don't remember. It was kind of hazy. And then I do remember her standing up, and I was still in the saddle, and I reached on, you know, cause you're in the chute, and I with my right hand and left hand reached and grabbed the side of the bucking chute to hold myself there. And I said, you know, I remember saying, you guys got to get me out of here. I just broke my back. Mm. And there was just this moment of like, you know, nobody knew what to do at first. And then, you know, they kind of jumped into action. They tied her, you know, in the chute. They brought a spine board. You know, the EMTs are at every rodeo. Mm-hmm. They brought a spine board and attached me to that and kind of slid me out from behind. And then, you know, I think adrenaline was keeping me conscious at that point. But then I was just very much in and out of consciousness for, you know, the next probably the next week, while they life flighted me to Minneapolis and did surgery. And that's when the journey really began,
yeah.
You know.
The sense of, you know, that, I don't know what to call it, regret, grief, all these things where, you know, when I think most people can empathize with something happening, whether it's a, you know, a broken arm or whatnot, where you remember, you think back at that moment just haunts you forever. But you're also saying that journey begins after that moment. How do you think about that moment in the shoot today? Are you able to let that go?
Yeah. So I think for me, you know, a lot of people don't want to think about like that kind of injury, you know, that kind of thing happening. But when it does happen, you're faced to reckon with it, and you're faced to think about, you know, what could I have done differently, or which doesn't do any good either. You know, history is history and what's done is done. But I often say this, that, and I suppose some people might look at me funny, but I truly believe it, that I wouldn't change anything. Even though, you know, knowing what I know now, I wouldn't change it. I don't know that I'd have said that. I wouldn't have said that a few weeks or maybe a few months after the injury, but I say it now because, you know, I ended up marrying Kelsey, my best friend. We were dating for a little while at the time, and you know, who knows what would have happened if we did, you know, what would have went on there, had I kept rodeoing, because I mean, you travel all over the United States, you're gone all the time. It's very grueling, and it's, you know, it's kind of a young person's lifestyle, to a certain degree. And so that could have potentially been challenging. And then, but we also have our son Liam, which, you know, I just, there's no way to guarantee that we would have Liam had this all not occurred. And it's also given me just a ton of opportunities to do different things and to be, I think, more impactful than I ever could have been, just, you know, going down the road rodeoing. So hindsight is interesting. To think about, but
let's talk about Kelsey for a minute, because I'm a big Kelsey Sutton fan, and I've never met her in person. But this idea that you know, you're 23 years old, you know, your future is ahead of you, and your future looks in this one way, which is you know, it's not a selfish way to look at your future, because most of us when we're 23 are looking at whatever world is wide open to us. And then, you know, you guys are dating for a couple weeks, and there is this person who also has a future in front of her who says, my future is tied to this person that I love. And here you are today doing all the things that you're doing. It's hard not. It's almost cliche. I almost feel guilty for saying, but it's hard not to honor Kelsey in this as much as, you know, your family and your community.
Yeah, I talk about that all the time, about, you know, how she just stuck by me through everything. And I gave her, you know, opportunities to leave. I remember even one conversation just saying, like, you know, this isn't probably the life that we had in mind. And you have, you know, I don't expect you to stick around, because I don't know. It's going to be hard, and it's going to be complicated, you know, moving and navigating through this, and just all the emotions and struggles that I was going to have to face individually, and then through our relationship and all those things. And I just remember, she didn't even blink. She just looked at me and said, no, I mean, like, we're in this together. And she says that she just knew that I was who she wanted to be with, and that, you know, she felt like it was meant to be. And it apparently was.
No tradition, no sport, no community gathering is without, you know, multifaceted layers. But just broadly speaking, if you would, as we close, what does rodeo mean to South Dakota? Like, what is South Dakota without rodeo? I mean, when you think of South Dakota, can you even separate it from rodeo in your mind?
I don't see how you could. You know, it's our state sport. It goes so far back into our, you know, who we are as a fabric in South Dakota, you know, very, very independent spirit, but hearts for our community, you know, and really what I mean by that is like hearts for the people around you, because rodeo is probably the unique of a sport as you'll ever find, in that you're competing against people, but you're not really competing against people. You're competing against the animal. And those friends that you make are the ones helping you to potentially beat them. Mm-hmm. And you become so close-knit through that, it becomes like you're like family. And so rodeo created that opportunity in it, and really that's where it began too, of, you know, people trying to break a horse or getting together to work cattle and making it, making some fun out of it, you know, and it just became a lifestyle that you live where you would give the shirt off your back to somebody in need, or you would help anybody that needs help. And that is so, that is so South Dakota to me.
Yeah.
And so I just don't see how you can separate them. They're one and the same. And about everybody has a connection, and, you know, if you're from South Dakota originally, especially, about everybody has a connection to some form of agriculture that connects to rodeo somehow. If you look deep enough.
We are just getting started, and Billy Sutton, I can't think of a better person to get started with. Thank you for being here today to talk about your experience and about rodeo in the state. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much, and really enjoyed it.
Yeah, we want to hear your rodeo stories, too. How did you get started in rodeo? What was the best rodeo moment you ever experienced, one that you'll never forget? You can call us and leave a message. We might use your story on air, too. Call 605-951-0740. Let's take a moment now for some South Dakota history. On this day in 1960, the USS South Dakota is officially stricken from the Naval Vessel Register. Now, South Dakota was actually a class of battleship. The South Dakota class was a group of four fast battleships built by the U.S. Navy. They included the South Dakota, the Indiana, the Massachusetts, and the Alabama. Construction of the USS South Dakota began on July 5, 1939. It launched in July 1941 and officially commissioned in March 1942 under the command of Captain Thomas Gatch. Armaments included a main battery of 9 16-inch 45 caliber Mark VI guns in 3-gun turrets. The ship was also equipped with 3 Kingfisher float planes. She carried a wartime crew of 2,500 and could reach a top sailing speed of 27 knots. That's just over 31 miles per hour. On October 26, 1942, those USS South Dakota anti-aircraft guns played a prominent role in the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands. During the engagement, the forward 16-inch gun turret was hit by a Japanese bomb. After repairs, the ship was heavily engaged and damaged again in action off Guadalcanal, a battle that effectively ended Japan's plan to retake the island. Following repairs in the U.S., the USS South Dakota operated in the Atlantic during 1943 and returned to the Pacific later with action at the Gilbert and Marshall Islands, the Marianas Campaign, and at Saipan and Tinian. The South Dakota supported the invasions of Leyte, Luzon, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa, and was present in Tokyo Bay on September 2, 1945, during the formal surrender of Japan. The USS South Dakota returned home soon thereafter and was decommissioned in January 1947. The ship remained inactive for another 15 years and was eventually sold for scrap, though some components were saved and incorporated into the Battleship Memorial in Sioux Falls. But it was on this day, 61 years ago, the USS South Dakota was officially removed from the Naval Vessel Register. Production assistance for This Day in South Dakota History comes from Dr. Brad Tennant, professor of history at Presentation College. Ahead on the program, more history, this time with old guitars and the local musicians who love them. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
As the news gets more complex and changes through the day, you need more than just a quick headline check. Here and Now keeps you connected to your world between Morning Edition and All Things Considered, as the news and the people shaping it are changing in real time. I'm Robin Young. Follow along on Here and Now, NPR News weekday afternoons.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding provided by First Dakota National Bank, supporting the businesses and individuals with a dream and the passion and drive to make it a reality. What will be your South Dakota first? More at firstdakota.com/first.
I am pleased to announce that SDPB has been awarded 9 Regional Edward R. Murrow Awards for our reporting in 2020. Winning categories include writing, video, features, sports, investigative reporting, continuing coverage, and the Overall Excellence Award. Your support makes it possible. Thank you for your partnership as we tell South Dakota stories. Award-winning reporting is what you have come to expect and what we continue to strive for at SDPB.
Program funding by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting this year's One Book South Dakota, The Children's Blizzard by Melanie Benjamin. Learn more about her virtual author tour and in-person Festival of Books appearance at sdhumanities.org.
Listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh. No instrument has had a bigger influence on the sound of popular music than the guitar. And certain makes and models of guitars become so closely identified with the people who play them, they acquire a fame all their own. We're continuing our series today about old guitars and the local musicians who love them with one of those special guitars, and SDPB producer Brian Gevick joins me now inside the Kirby Family Studio in the SDPB Sioux Falls Studio, face-to-face.
In the same room.
In the flesh.
It's great. It's great, yeah.
Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you.
All right, Jay Gilbertson. This, you know, the fun thing about this is it's really about guitars, but it's also about these people who...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The professional musicians, and we're talking to some great ones, really. Yeah. Jay, he is a professional guitarist. He lives in Yankton, as we've said. He's been playing since he was about 14. So a lot of people in southeastern South Dakota have been, you know, they've been listening to him since probably the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. He has a really special guitar, and the guitar players out there are going to know this right away. It's a 1964 Fender Stratocaster. One of the things that make it really special is that it's kind of the last of Fender's all-handmade Stratocasters. CBS bought Fender in 1965. They did some things differently, and some people feel like they just didn't build them as well. I asked Jay to talk about some of this particular Stratocaster's features, and when he's done talking about it, he's going to play a bit for us.
What I like about it, of course, is just the tone, and what the tone comes from is this old wood that they made these guitars out of. The body of this is alder, which is a really hard wood, and the sound of these, of the wood of this guitar is just fantastic. It's got an all maple neck, Brazilian rosewood fingerboard, which they, you know, you have to pay a top dollar to get that on a guitar these days, and they just don't build them like that anymore. Everything was hand sanded, you know, hand put, not a CNC machine, you know, and the pickups were all wound with a, you know, with that old style winding, old style, you know, materials that they used back then. And with age, they even sound cooler. You know, but Jimi Hendrix was playing a 66 and a 67 Strat. Those were after CBS, and he made them sound incredible. But that's kind of what myself and my friends go for, is we want to try to get that sound. So you go back and get those kind of guitars that those guys played.
We'll be right back. There it is. Yeah. Sorry, that was, it sounds a little familiar to me. What's he playing there?
That's Jay Gilbertson playing some Stevie Ray Vaughan for us.
Oh, okay, thank you.
And that's a beautiful sound. You know, electric guitars can make all kinds of different sounds, and there's different tones. So I asked Jay to kind of tweak it a little bit and play something else. Same guitar, but just listen to how different it sounds. Tip your bartender.
That's somebody's driveway moment right there.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're welcome.
Yep.
There's more to this series coming.
Yeah.
Who are we going to meet next or in the days ahead?
Well, in the days ahead, and this will go through June and into July, we're going to talk to a guy a lot of people know, Boyd Bristow, also Nick Schwabach, who's been around forever in Sioux Falls in Southeast South Dakota. We're going to hear more from Mike Hilson. He was here a couple of weeks ago. He's from USD and gigs a lot. We're talking with Scott Simpson, who I think you know.
Yes.
Also a poet, very interesting guy. James Van Nuys from Rapid City. We're going to do a segment with him, and it's just, I mean, he plays electric and he plays acoustic, he plays a resonator, and we just had a great time.
I watched him play in Rapid City in our studio there, and I didn't even know what to ask him. I was like, what do you say after that?
The music has
said everything that needs to be said. Yeah. Brian Gevick, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
To see photos of more rare guitars and hear clips of those guitars being played, go to our website, sdpb.org/music. For the first time in 9 years, master ledger artist Donald Montolo will display his work at the Dahl Arts Center in Rapid City. Beginning Friday, you can see horses, buffaloes, and teepees, a new exhibit of Montolo's ledger art. And Don Montolo joins us now from the Black Hill Surgical Hospital studio inside SDPB's Rapid Studio. Welcome. Thanks for being here again.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate that.
This is a big event for gallery goers, but there are plenty of places to see your artwork, you know, across the state of South Dakota and really across the country. For people who haven't seen your work before, describe ledger art and kind of the work that you put together and some of the themes that you're drawn to again and again.
Okay, well, originally my mentor was Herman Redelk and Oscar Howe. Very noted artists in their own right. But Herman Redelk was a hide painter, and I really mentored under him a lot more. And every time we'd go to an art show, Herman would win first, second, and third place because he was the master. And I thought, this is not my gig because I've got a real ego. And so I researched, and historically, once the buffalo were gone from the plains, they turned to trading for bartered for ledger books from storekeepers and soldiers. And they put the same image that was on the buffalo hide onto the ledger books.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, this is great because Herman can be the master of the buffaloes. Oscar can be the master of all other forms of art, but I can be the master of ledger art.
And one of the things that I just admire, and I think a lot of people are drawn to again and again with your sense of work, is a sense of motion. Oh. And I wonder if you could talk about that to a radio audience and just how do you think when you sit down and want to capture movement and motion, how is that even done?
Well, again, I go back to Herman. We were sitting on top of a hill, and Herman was telling me a story about how warriors always look for an advantage point. They always look for a rise, and they would go down into the battle. They would run down into the battle. And they all had a little pouch on the corner of their horse's mouth, which was filled with herbs and spices. And when they were going down this hill, they'd pull this spice pocket into their horse's mouth, and he said their horses would just fly. Hmm. And as soon as he said that, my horses never galloped or loped again. My horses fly. And so if you can imagine a horse flying, you can look at my horses and see them.
Yeah. What has this past year been like for you? Because you're a teaching artist as well, and you're doing your own work, and it's a time to rethink so many things about how we are in the world. Tell me a story about this past year for you as an artist.
Well, I think all of us artists, it's like coming to a railroad track with this speeding freight train coming down the road, and he goes by, and you slam on your brakes, and everything stops. Mm. And that's what happened. Everything stopped. 6 major art shows throughout the country pulled the plug. Nothing. All the schools shut the doors. Nothing. And I think as artists, we went, what? What's going on? You know, yeah. we thrive with people. We live to have people in our lives. And you sit in your studio and you still have that creativity that you want to do. But where do I show? What do I do? Who do I talk to? You know, it was like a cave. Things just quit. Hmm. It was bad.
Yeah. Okay, so you said cave, and it reminds me of the great Joseph Campbell who said, the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure that you seek. So is there any treasure in that cave? Is it just an endurance? I don't want to put pressure on anybody who got nothing done during the pandemic, right? Because we all have these, like, high expectations. But was there treasure in that cave at all now that we're emerging?
You're going to see so many treasures come out of that cave, jewels and gold blowing out of there. And that's going to be June 4th at 5 o'clock. I'm going to give an artist talk at the Doll.
Yeah.
And you'll be able to look at all these fantastic pieces of artwork that Donald Motlow does. I'm not one to tell how good I am myself, you know, but I like to blow my horn.
Yeah. We'll blow it for you loud and proudly, because this is the first time in 9 years, I think, that you've been at the Doll. For you, what is an exhibition like versus all these other sort of, you know, ways that you interact with people? And then it's a gallery space. It's the horses and the buffaloes and the teepees and these themes and these flying horses in this static space that is no longer static.
You know, what I really want everybody to look at is my artwork, because what I try to do is I try to not make it two-dimensional. What I try to do is have it three-dimensional. Yeah. So I try to make my horses and buffalo and teepees all actually come off this piece of paper. And if I can show one person, or if I can hear one person say, you know, I think I can see Don's horses fly, that makes the whole night for me. And I do. I've got my eyes done. I had cataracts on my eyes, and I've got them redone. And I think the colors that you're going to see is a more vibrant color than you've seen before in my things. And I think I've got 14 pieces that I've created specifically for this show. And so I really encourage everybody to come down and look at me. Yeah. And I really want to look at you, too, because I missed you.
Right.
I really missed you.
I'm getting excited to just go out there and look. So you can be part of that this Friday. That's June 4th. Artist reception from 4 to 7 local time there at the Doll Art Center. And don't miss the artist talk at 5 p.m. Again, that's local time. Donald, thank you so much.
Thank
it's nice
you,
to talk to you again.
I hope to see you Friday.